This episode of Food Psych is brought to you by my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. If you're ready to break free from diet culture and reclaim the life it stole from you, learn more and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course. That's ChristyHarrison.com/course. Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast about intuitive eating, health at every size, body liberation, and taking down diet culture. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm an anti-diet registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, and author of the forthcoming book, Anti-Diet, Reclaim Your Time, Money, Well-being, and Happiness Through Intuitive Eating, which is available for pre-order now. Join me here every week as I talk with interesting people from all walks of life about their relationships with food and their bodies. And by the way, on this show, we bleep out diet culture stuff like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome to episode 214 of Food Psych. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and today I'm talking with fellow anti-diet dietitian and friend of the pod, Kimmy Singh. We discuss her experiences being diagnosed with and living with polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS, fat phobia and racism in healthcare and dietetics training, how reframing beauty ideals helped in her eating disorder recovery, why eating disorder providers need to talk to their clients about fat phobia, and so much more. I can't wait to share our conversation with you in just a moment. But first, I will answer this week's listener question. It's from a listener with initials CK who writes, "Hi, Christy. Thanks for doing the amazing work you're doing. I'm encountering disturbing practices at my children's school. My seven-year-old came home and didn't want to enjoy her glass of chocolate milk because it, quote unquote, has too many calories," she said after she read the nutrition label. It turns out the first grade teacher is teaching them how to read nutrition labels and not to consume things if there's too many calories. I'm completely appalled and angry about this, especially since my kindergartner's in the same school. I went through a debilitating eating disorder myself and am now thoroughly anti-diet and seeing dieting and diet culture for what it is. My question is, how do I approach this with the school? I'm sure they think this is okay and quote unquote healthy, but they're really just damaging young minds who should be focused on coloring pictures and not reading nutrition labels before every meal. We're teaching them how wrong this is at home, but teachers have a huge influence, so I feel I need to contact the school and try to stop it. Thank you for your time if you get a chance to read this. So thanks, CK, for that great question, and so many thoughts on this. But before I answer, just my standard disclaimer that these answers and this podcast in general are for informational and educational purposes only and aren't a substitute for individual medical or mental health advice. So first of all, my heart really goes out to you for having to deal with this. I know how hard it is on parents trying to raise anti-diet kids when our whole culture, everything that surrounds them and surrounds us, is diet culture. And especially having your own eating disorder history, I know how visceral your sense of anger and frustration with this probably is. So I would definitely contact the school and talk with these teachers about the issues with this, the issues with teaching kids about calorie counting and reading nutrition labels. And I think your intuition is spot on that it really is important to contact the school and talk to them about this. So these teachers probably think they're doing the right thing and they live in diet culture. So I'm sure they believe that calorie counting is good and is going to help these kids, quote unquote, stay healthy, right? So it's important that you share with them that this actually has really negative, unintended consequences that they weren't aware of. Because I think they want to do good. You know, everyone, for the most part, has good intentions, especially educators. And so just alerting them to the fact that this is actually really problematic might be helpful. I think one of the best strategies, if you're up for it, is to share a little bit about your own story of disordered eating and recovery and talk about what you've learned through that process. You know, talk about how things like calorie counting and reading nutrition labels play into eating disorders in general, how they played into your own eating disorder, and how kids and adults alike can become really obsessed with these things, and how especially with kids who tend to be very literal thinkers, right? They already have sort of black and white thinking about the world in general because they're kids. They haven't gotten to that sense of nuance yet that we develop in, you know, usually teenage years or young adulthood. And so lessons like this about reading nutrition labels or counting calories can lead kids to really black and white thinking, really rigid thinking about food that is the hallmark of disordered eating, that is a huge risk factor for developing a full-blown eating disorder or just severely disordered eating behaviors. You can also talk to the teachers about the evidence against calorie counting from a more scientific perspective or physiological perspective, because in general, kids don't need to count calories. Nobody needs to count calories. Our bodies do a great job of figuring out what they need and getting their energy needs met without any intervention from us. But especially for kids, you know, they're in kindergarten and first grade, right? Your first grader, it sounds like, is the one who's getting taught these calorie counting things. Most kids at this point still have a good connection to their intuitive relationship with food and their bodies. And so they don't need to count calories. They just need to trust that inner wisdom, that intuition that they're still connected with, their hunger, their fullness, their satisfaction cues, and, you know, what they're interested in eating. And if we allow kids to do that, if we allow them to continue and maintain that intuitive relationship with food that we're all born with, kids are going to be far better off and they're going to grow into far more well-adjusted adults than if we interfere with that innate connection with food so young, especially. So giving kids a blanket recommendation to eat as few calories as possible is also extremely harmful from that physiological level, because even if calorie counting weren't a risk factor for disordered eating, which it is, and we'll talk more about that in a second, but even if it weren't, kids need lots of energy from food because they're growing, right? They're growing very rapidly. And it's nearly impossible to calculate a child's calorie needs accurately because they're always going through different phases of growth and development. So their energy needs change really quickly and are usually increasing over time. And kids are supposed to have their energy needs increase over time. They're supposed to gain weight, right? And so, you know, I don't use weight numbers in this podcast. And like I said in the intro, if anyone says them in the podcast, I bleep them out. So I'm not going to say exact amounts, exact numbers here. But generally, kids' weight at least needs to quadruple from first grade until they're fully grown, right? It's on average, their weight is going to go up fourfold probably. And so trying to restrict their eating during that time is really dangerous because it restricts their growth. It restricts their ability to feel, you know, their body's ability to feel that its needs are going to be met and that it's going to be able to grow and develop as it wants to, right? The body needs to have all of its energy needs met in order to feel safe. And so that relates back to the disordered eating issue that I was talking about before, which is that when kids or really people in general deprive themselves of certain foods because they deem them to be too high in calories, or when they're deprived of certain foods from outside sources, right? Food insecurity or someone else putting them on a diet, that sets them up for a restrict binge cycle, or what I call the restriction pendulum. And that's where you restrict, and then inevitably end up swinging over to the side of feeling out of control with food, and particularly gravitating toward the foods that you hadn't allowed yourself. Because forbidden fruit always tastes the sweetest, right? We know that. And that is really true in research, especially with regard to this restrict binge cycling. People tend to gravitate towards the foods that they were restricted of. I talk in my book about a study that deprived women of chocolate, of chocolatey foods for a week. And at the end of the week of deprivation, everybody's desire for chocolate, for chocolatey foods, on average was higher. And that was particularly pronounced in the people who were dieters already. The people who were dieters had significantly higher cravings for chocolate and chocolatey foods. And so, you know, nothing is wrong with cravings, right? And honoring your cravings is a great thing to do in the process of making peace with food. But the fact is that depriving yourself of certain foods actually ends up driving greater cravings for those foods. And that kind of restriction and deprivation is really a lasting form of trauma that can stay with a kid all the way into adulthood. And, you know, at this point, I've had more than 200 guests on this podcast share about their relationships with food growing up, right? That's the first question I ask in every episode. And I'd say most of them had some form of food restriction and or body shaming in childhood that messed up their relationships with food for years, if not decades. And I get letters from people all the time saying the same thing, that something that happened when they were 5, 6, 7, 8 years old kicked off disordered eating that still continues to this day. So schools should not be participating in this form of body-based shame and trauma. And yet far too many are, because we live in diet culture. You know, whether it's sending kids home with body mass index report cards, weighing them in front of a room full of their peers, labeling foods as good or bad, healthy or unhealthy, or teaching them to count calories and read nutrition labels like your school is, all of these things are potentially traumatizing moments in a child's life. So if we want our kids to grow up to be peaceful, well-adjusted people, we need to help them have peaceful, well-adjusted relationships with food, because trauma around food really threatens our sense of peace at a fundamental level, because it threatens our survival. Another thing you could do when talking to these teachers is to maybe give them some resources for further reading. I think you can make a really impassioned case with your own background, your own story, and some of the things that I've been sharing here. But if you want to give them something to read and sort of reinforce what you're saying, one resource that might be helpful is my New York Times op-ed about the Weight Watchers app for kids, which it gets at a lot of the issues with restricting kids and depriving kids of food, and also, you know, restricting and depriving anyone of food, and the astronomical failure rate of diets, and why weight cycling and weight stigma are likely a greater risk to your health than body size itself. And so that's actually important, because I think when teachers are engaging in this sort of teaching, odds are, and not in every case, you know, sometimes this is just handed down from the district, but odds are that teacher maybe has a personal interest in dieting, right? Maybe they're particularly caught up in diet culture themselves. And so I think maybe that piece could help them also understand why diets don't work for adults as well, and why it's really harmful to foment diet culture and pursue dieting. Another great resource on this that you could give them is this piece by Reagan Chastain, 2-time past food site guest Reagan Chastain. She also did a great piece for US News about that Weight Watchers app for kids. And so we'll link to that in the show notes as well, because I think that can give you some more reinforcements, just some more voices and other people in the field speaking out against this app and against dieting for kids in general. Really, the issue is your school, your kids' school, is teaching kids dieting behaviors and disordered eating behaviors, aka counting calories and trying to reduce or restrict their calories. And so the teachers need to understand how harmful it is to teach kids dieting behaviors and how likely it is to lead to adverse consequences down the line. So I hope that's helpful. And if you want to submit your own question for a chance to have it answered on an upcoming episode of the pod, go to christyharrison.com/questions. That's christyharrison.com/questions. And then if you want to ask me any question you want and have me answer it a lot more quickly than I can here, you can join my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. There, I do an exclusive monthly Q&A podcast where you get to ask your own questions and listen to hundreds of answers that I've already given to other questions, so that you can really troubleshoot any areas where you're getting stuck with intuitive eating and truly make peace with food. And some exciting news, which is for a limited time, when you pre-order my book, Anti-Diet, you'll also get a special deal on this course, on the Intuitive Eating Fundamentals course. So to learn more about that deal and claim yours today by pre-ordering the book, you can go to christyharrison.com/book. That's christyharrison.com/book. And then to learn more about the course itself and how it can help you break free from diet culture and reclaim your life for bigger and better things, you can go to christyharrison.com/course. That's christyharrison.com/course. And now, without any further ado, let's go talk to Kimmy Singh. So tell me about your relationship with food growing up.
Gosh, you know, it felt like I remember a point in my childhood when food became something that was sort of off limits in a lot of ways. And so I have this very brief memory of when food felt okay and safe. And then I remember a time where I was told to, quote unquote, watch my weight. And so food started to feel much more charged. It didn't feel like something I had unconditional permission around. And then I obviously also felt like less in control of it too.
How old were you when that happened?
Good question. I'm thinking I was about like 6 or 7 years old. I think about 7 years old. Yeah, I remember just being like, oh, I miss the days when I was allowed to enjoy things. And I started to also just feel uncomfortable in my body. That being said, I still had a body with a lot of privilege, but I did have a body that doctor said, like, yeah, you got to be careful. And it really just put so much awareness on how I how I felt. And I also, so for listeners that don't know me personally, so I'm Indian and I grew up at that point of my childhood in a predominantly white area. So I just sort of felt like I looked different, not only around size, but also around skin color and hair color. And I have curly hair. And it just felt like, why does my body look different from everybody else's? Like, why don't I look like the Barbies? I mean, literally, because I had Barbies, you know, at that age. So I just felt like my relationship with food and body throughout childhood felt very murky. And then since my father immigrated here from India, as like many immigrants, there's so much pressure to conform. And I just felt like as I progressed throughout childhood, I really felt like I just want to look like everybody else. I want to fit in. I don't want to have a special, unique identity that makes me different.
In some ways, it sounds like having the pressure to lose weight was also a pressure to assimilate.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Yeah, this is kind of timely that we're recording this because I remember when I was a child, I would see the advertisements for all the diets, like the 90s era diets. And I remember at the end, they would have a disclaimer that like, yeah, this is not for people under the age of 18. And as a child, I felt so angry. Like, why aren't they thinking of people like me? And I also felt really alone, like, well, most people don't look like me. So why would they think of people like me? And it makes me really angry because I know that now with the whole Curbo app for children, I would have loved that. And my parents wouldn't have had the knowledge to not put me on that sort of plan, if that makes sense. But yeah, it's terrible to think about.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, that kids like have their own desires to lose weight or desires to change their body coming from that external pressure, right? Because already at that point you felt it, you felt like there was something wrong with you and that you were getting those messages from outside of yourself and then internalizing them and kind of wishing for some app or some diet or, well, not an app, didn't exist back then probably, but like some diet to change things for you.
Yeah, it really mirrored what I would see amongst adults, conversations by adults, whether it was on TV or like between my parents. And so I just felt like I had so much exposure to this idea that dieting was possible and it was something I should be doing.
It's wild how young kids are when they internalize those messages, right?
It really is. Yeah. And somehow, as I sort of progressed like through the teenage years, it felt like it calmed down. And I was reflecting on this before today. I don't know why it calmed down, but I do know that at that time I moved to a different area where I had more community of color. And I feel like I felt like less of the other. And I can't help but think that had a really big piece of it. And I feel like my racial identity began to really grow. And I just felt like I wasn't the odd one out all the time.
So in some ways, it wasn't just about your size. It was about all of the ways that your body felt like it didn't fit in. And once you felt a little more represented and like you fit in, you had a place, then some of that dieting pressure died down too.
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, like there was a piece of my body feeling like it fit in, but there was also this piece of being around people with shared experiences. And so even if it was just relating to things that I would see in my household or jokes about my family. And like, as the internet was becoming more and more popular, it was a great way to get connected to people with similar experiences.
Yeah. Like that empathy that was probably missing when you didn't have people with similar experiences around you before.
Yeah. And so I didn't feel like I was just this single person experiencing all these things on my own.
That's so powerful and so important. I think whatever identity you're feeling othered by, or even combination of identities often, it's like finding people who get it and who have had a similar experience or can just empathize with you seems to go such a long way in being resilient to that, whatever stigma and stuff you face in the larger culture.
Yeah, exactly. It makes all the difference. It really does.
So what happened in your relationship with food and your body then around, that was teenage years, you said, or?
Yeah, these were the teenage years. So I definitely was on the wellness diet, and I can remember not feeling satisfied with what I was eating, but it felt like I had more control because I had that independence. So yeah, it didn't feel as stressful and as chaotic as it was in childhood. But then, fast forward to college. College is that time where it all just kind of came at me. And I think there are a lot of reasons why I felt a lot of pressure to like shrink my body. And like I said, like at this time, I was in a body size that had a lot of thin privilege. And so it still felt like it wasn't enough. And I still felt really uncomfortable in my body. And I always asked myself like how this would have been different if I didn't have that privilege.
It's so interesting too, to think about the nuances of thin privilege, because, you know, you said like you, as a kid, you were told by doctors that you needed to watch it or that you needed to lose weight, yet still you had a degree of thin privilege. So it's like, it's not all or nothing, right? It's not black and white.
Yeah, it's really not. And something I mentioned recently at a talk that you were at is that it's so difficult to discuss thin privilege when we're comparing it to other types of privilege, because not only does your body change, but also in different groups, you have different size standards. And on top of that, like you also have this fear of being fat or knowing what it feels like to quote unquote feel fat. So you can feel uncomfortable in your body, and that doesn't mean that you have a pass from having thin privilege. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You can feel, quote unquote, feel fat in the sense of like having these eating disorder beliefs or these internalized diet culture beliefs and fat phobia making you feel like fat is bad and judging your body for being bigger than some arbitrary standard you have in your head. But that doesn't mean that you actually are bigger than the ridiculous standard our society sets forth for people in terms of like, you know, who gets good medical care at the doctor versus who just gets told to lose weight, who gets one airplane seat and pays for one airplane seat versus who has to pay for two, all of that stuff. Having a sense of yourself as being too big doesn't mean that you actually do experience those levels of stigma in our society.
Exactly. And so it's not like you have this systemic oppression, which is such a larger scale. Yeah, it's so different. But when I was kind of in my late teenage years, early college, I just sort of felt like I was hitting this age where I wanted to be thinner. And I do think some of it is cultural, because like in my community, there is a lot of pressure on how you look before you're like at the marriage age. And I just felt like, okay, I'm approaching this time in my life and my body should be smaller. I need to get serious. Serious.
Oh my.
Yeah, it's so funny that I associated seriousness with dieting. But yeah, so I just felt like the weight cycling and dieting that I had in the background of like my household and my own life felt like it ran to the forefront. And so I started restricting a lot and dieting a lot and just weight cycling left and right. And yeah, what a time.
Oh boy. Yeah. It sounds really chaotic.
Yeah, it was really chaotic. Then in the middle of one of those weight cycles, I was diagnosed with PCOS. And that really, it's interesting because it didn't really change things, because at the time I was diagnosed with PCOS, my doctor just said like, yeah, I think you have PCOS. You might have trouble conceiving. I'll get the nurse to give you a pamphlet. And that was it. The nurse gave me a pamphlet, no explanation. And it felt very confusing because, I mean, at that point I was 19. I wasn't really interested in conceiving at that point at all. I knew that one day I wanted to, but a lot of the symptoms in the pamphlet, it just didn't feel like I was experiencing. So I was kind of questioning, do I even have this diagnosis? And I was kind of running through all the symptoms. And when weight gain was listed, I think that was the one that felt most alarming, because it felt like the most scary because of my own internalized fat phobia. But because where I was at that place, I was restricting. I was in that part of my weight cycling pattern. I was restricting. So I thought, oh no, that doesn't apply to me. So yeah, it's funny how that happened.
What made them think you had PCOS? Like what made the doctors give you that diagnosis?
Gosh, I don't know at that time. I know that we were just sort of talking and it could have been like about facial hair. And I know that they did some blood work after and they called me and just to confirm then. But Yeah, I guess the doctor seemed pretty sure when she told me.
Wow. So she kind of was just like diagnosing you based on little evidence, but then it turned out it was confirmed afterwards.
Exactly. Exactly. And I do think that if at that time I was in a larger body, I probably would have heard more from her. I do think so. Not necessarily about PCOS care, but just kind of some of the guilt trips that are given to people with PCOS.
Totally. And so we've covered PCOS on the podcast before, but just for anyone who's new and coming to this for the first time, do you want to give a little rundown of like what that stands for and what it is, what the diagnosis means?
So polycystic ovarian syndrome, also known as PCOS, is a disorder. And sometimes people do have cysts on their ovaries. Sometimes they have irregular periods. Sometimes they have elevated testosterone. So you kind of have to have two out of those three to be diagnosed. And there are also some other symptoms kind of just around body and metabolism. And I think when I think back to my own diagnosis, what makes me the most frustrated is that I wasn't told that PCOS also affects mood, that PCOS also affects energy levels and sleep and your relationship with food and body. And that's one thing where the conception piece was definitely mentioned to me. And I think that goes to show how society does like put so much value on being able to like, I don't know, like this idea of cis women, like being able to reproduce, like this old school idea. And it seems very patriarchal to me that that's the only thing that's usually mentioned, as if our worth and kind of our value around mood and these other things are not important. I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah.
Oh my God, totally. That is such a great point because it really prioritizes this one aspect of your body and your identity, which I mean is super complicated for so many people, you know, especially like trans people who have PCOS or non-binary people who have PCOS or just cis women who don't want to conceive or ambivalent about it or have, you know, strong desires for it and are feeling terrible when they hear that they might not be able to. And so it's just like, ugh, it's the fact that that is sort of foregrounded with a PCOS diagnosis makes me so upset because it just, I think it hurts so many people and yeah, just dismisses all these other aspects of the disorder that might be more germane to like someone's everyday existence and functioning in the world, like the mood stuff or other hormonal issues that might just affect your day-to-day life or cause symptoms, cause pain, not just about reproduction.
Yes, exactly. And so many of these other symptoms, people think that it's almost like the idea that they're the only ones experiencing that once again. And yeah, like it's so eye-opening to me when I see symptoms amongst my clients with PCOS and how each one of them feels so alone. And when I tell them, no, this is actually a really common part of having PCOS, it's this moment of validation and this time that they've been questioning their body when they felt this experience. So I do feel like better learning about my PCOS and how I can support it really helped nourish my relationship with food and body.
That's awesome. And it's great that you're talking about it and helping to destigmatize it because I think some of the symptoms of PCOS are so stigmatized and people feel so ashamed of having them that it can be really hard to break out of that and like actually acknowledge this is not my fault. This is part of a symptom, you know, situation that my body is in. Maybe not even a lot of people don't even, or some people don't even necessarily categorize it as a problem. You know, it's just, this is how my body is. This is a different way that my body functions and it's okay. And I can manage it. I can take care of it.
Yeah, exactly. I really don't like when I hear it being presented as this terrible negative thing that takes over these people's lives. Because I think that any diagnosis, just to describe it in that way, is very ableist. That's one piece of it. And then also, there's so much more to the PCOS experience than just the hard times.
Right, totally. And yeah, just sort of distilling it down to those hard times or to like, well, your life's going to be tough is really, yeah, really ableist, like you said, and also just sort of dismisses people's ability to function and be resilient and work with different conditions.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And that's something, so I know you interviewed Julie Duffy Dillon before, but so like she and I co-hosted the PCOS and Food Peace podcast, where we interviewed people, you know, kind of the big shots in the quasi positive, fat positive communities that happened to have PCOS. And I think what was most eye opening to me was how many people reached out and said, I can't believe that there's this much to the PCOS experience that I haven't heard about before.
Wow. That's really interesting. And I think speaks to, yeah, the fact that it's just such a silent, you know, it's a condition that creates a lot of shame and silence. And I think because of so much of like our patriarchal standards of beauty and femininity and how a quote unquote woman's body should function, like there's just so much shame tied up in that, that it's hard for people to speak out about it. So it's really cool to have. And yeah, that podcast like has such amazing guests. They're all, you know, a lot of them are people I've talked to on this podcast too. And they're just like powerful voices in our community and sharing their PCOS stories. So, so awesome. And I'm sure so healing for other people.
Yeah, I agree. And I appreciate that the way we did it was, it's not about like overcoming something. You know what I'm saying? It's just kind of about being with your body. And I think it's a really different way to look at chronic illness.
Totally. As we're recording this, I'm having a flare up of one of my chronic illnesses, Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And I've been thinking a lot about the sort of definition of health and wellness that is so often used in our society, that is so ableist, right? That sort of says that if you have any sort of disease or any kind of active condition or symptoms, then you're not well, you're not healthy, and that your job is like to get rid of them, right? To overcome your symptoms or overcome your illness so that you can reach this mythic state of health and well-being. And I just think that's bullshit. You know, as someone who has this chronic condition, a number of chronic conditions that come and go and, you know, have a lot to do with stress, or in this case, stress and medication management. Like I had a ridiculous rocky 6 months or so with my doctor putting me on a different dose of this medication that just threw everything out of whack, and trying to get my levels right. And it is what it is. But I mean, I'm feeling very tired. I'm feeling slowed down by this disease, but also have had some of the most productive couple of months of my career and had some incredibly fulfilling work that I've been doing, and like wonderful, relaxing, fun times with my family and my friends. And, you know, my life is so much richer and so much more than just this diagnosis. And I feel like I'm kicking ass and having a great time and also fucking exhausted, and it's all there, you know?
Yes, it is. And you definitely are kicking ass just to validate you in that moment.
Thank you.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, and I think there's one piece of it, like when you're having a symptom that you don't particularly enjoy, it can be really hard to be with your body. And I also think that having the compassion and gentleness with yourself in that moment is so important. It shouldn't be about getting angry that you can't control your body. It should be trying to find stillness in that moment.
Yeah, that self-compassion is so huge. And that's been such a huge part of it for me too. And like, I just want to acknowledge too my privilege, because even though I have Hashimoto's and other chronic illnesses that I live with, I'm also still in a thin body and like a body that is, for all intents and purposes, able-bodied, even though it has these limitations, these conditions, and cisgender and white and all the rest. So I feel like my experience of even navigating the healthcare system or moving through the world, nobody sees me as like this sick person, quote unquote, even if I'm having like a moment of feeling not well, you know, like it's different having an invisible illness, I think, versus like chronic illness that makes people a target, you know, visibly a target.
Oh yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I guess just to acknowledge my privilege here, specifically as it relates to PCOS, I think that a lot of times trans people that have PCOS are really left out of the conversation. And there are so many issues with that. But I think one of the most harmful things is it kind of tells them that their experience isn't valid and they don't have a place in the PCOS communities online. And so like, as I have found like more research that says there's a really high prevalence of folks that are trans who have PCOS, it really bothers me that there's not more resources. And so I guess like for any providers or people with PCOS that are listening, I'd recommend them to stop saying women with PCOS, because it is really exclusive to people that are not women.
Yep, totally. People who are not women can have ovaries and PCOS and get pregnant or try to get pregnant, or, you know, all the, or have periods, like all of these different things. And those things are not just limited to women. I love like this phrase, like, you know, people with periods or people with PCOS, just to sort of validate, like, that everybody's included.
Yeah, exactly. I'm hoping that the way we try to manage PCOS will just, I guess, I'm hoping it'll step away from let's try to promote femininity, this feminine appearance as we understand it, because that's not going to be everybody's goal, and that's okay. And we, you know what I'm saying? It's right now, I feel like that's a big part of the PCOS dialogues that I see, like, online and whatnot.
Right. It's like, how can we, like, remove facial hair or get rid of, you know, like, anything else that seems like unfeminine, quote unquote, rather than, and, you know, that obviously is everybody's, has their individual journey with that stuff and their own gender expression that they feel comfortable with. But, like, I feel like so much of it is just handed down from patriarchy, and people haven't really had a chance to explore all of the ways that, like, they might relate to PCOS symptoms that have nothing to do with the gender binary or, like, gendered ideas about beauty and stuff.
Exactly.
What was your journey with that stuff like? Did you, when you first were diagnosed, did you have sort of a reaction to it from a sense of, like, wanting to fit in with patriarchal standards of beauty and fix or manage PCOS symptoms that were outside of that? Or,
yeah, great question. So at that time, I was someone who did not have a lot of social awareness. And I'm very comfortable intentionally mentioning this because I think it's just sort of a testament that people can grow. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, I didn't have the depth to really analyze it in that way. Aside from that, I was really questioning the validity of my diagnosis because I felt like there were a lot of symptoms that I was not experiencing. And also, like, I had facial hair, but I'm also, like I said, I'm Indian, and it's fairly common. So I just didn't know how seriously to take it. But then kind of fast forward to, gosh, I think it was just 7 or 8 months after my diagnosis, my body started changing. I started to gain weight in such a way that I was losing my thin privilege really quickly. And so I put it that way really intentionally, because a lot of times when people describe a sudden weight gain, they describe it as this terrible thing, this big tragedy. And I don't think it was a big tragedy, but I think it was not cool that I had to experience fat phobia all of a sudden. And that was the tragedy. The fat phobia still is the tragedy. So after my body started changing, I just also noticed that my PCOS symptoms were changing. And that's when I was like, oh gosh, this is probably a real thing that I really have. And so let me get this checked out. And so when I went to the doctor, the same doctor for the first time since having that major, like, weight change within a short amount of time, the doctor was livid. When I say livid, like, yelling at the top of her lungs, and recommended weight loss surgery, didn't ask any questions about what was going on. Like, meanwhile, I was really not in a great place in my relationship with food. And I also kind of came from this mindset, like, before this happened, I was somebody that really put my value in how beautiful I felt I was to the world. And so it wasn't about who I was as a person. It really was about what I was putting out there. And so when my body started changing and I didn't see that as beautiful, it made it really difficult to feel connected to myself. So there was a lot going on in that moment.
It sounds like you were going through a lot in your relationship with food and your body, which I would love to, like, hear more about too, sort of what was happening for you in that. But then your doctor just completely negated all of that by yelling at you for the size of your body. And it was like nothing you were going through as a human being mattered in that moment.
Yeah, exactly. It felt like I didn't realize that I was struggling with my relationship with food and body. It just felt like I needed to restrict. I had to get, quote unquote, serious again. And yeah, it just felt like I was doing something wrong and I couldn't control it as my body was changing. So it felt like it was spiraling and I didn't understand why I couldn't restrict enough. And then there was also this really big piece of coming to terms with a changing body and navigating the world without having this image that I thought I had before. And honestly, like, in hindsight, it was a great thing that I don't know. It's not like a great thing that I was sad, but I think it's great that I was able to eventually find liberation, because living your life around how other people perceive you, especially as it relates to beauty, that's not a way to live. Soon after that, I started eating disorder recovery. And this was right after college, after I finished studying physics. And it felt really eye-opening because I spent so much of my life learning about diets and ways to restrict and all different approaches to food that were rooted in weight loss. And I didn't realize that there was this whole other world of intuitive eating. And it felt like I was really at a rock bottom when it came to dieting.
What made you realize you were at the rock bottom? What was it that pushed you to get help?
It didn't make sense that this cycle kept on happening. Like I felt like I was losing control, but I was also maxing out how much I can restrict, just I guess physically. And so it just, something didn't add up. And that's when I was like, okay, I need a little more support here. And I would never have guessed that I had an eating disorder. I was definitely of the mindset that I'm in a fat body, or I didn't use the word fat, but I'm in a larger body. So there's no amount of restriction that's off limits.
Right. So you thought like you should be able to restrict in an unlimited way.
Yeah. And so my doctor yelling at me, although that wasn't great, I didn't think it was a big deal because I thought, yeah, like that's in line with how things should be right now.
Oh my God. That's so sad. And just to think like how traumatizing that is for people to be yelled at by their doctor, which again, if you're really in it, you probably don't recognize it as trauma or as fat phobia and weight stigma, which it is. But like, that seems like par for the course, I think, for a lot of people. But also that's why so many people in larger bodies avoid going to the doctor because they don't want to have an experience like that. And for good reason, but then, you know, people end up worse off in terms of their health when they avoid going to the doctor because they have conditions that go on longer than they need to. And then they end up with worse health conditions overall, which is one of the ways in which weight stigma contributes to worse health for people in larger bodies, which is like completely avoidable if we didn't have fat phobia in our medical system the way we do.
Yes, exactly. I couldn't agree more.
So it sounds like you were seeking out, were you like looking for an eating disorder specialist or were you looking for like someone to help me diet, like someone to help me fix the problem that is my body?
Yeah. So I knew I had a deeper issue, but I didn't know it was an eating disorder. So I was looking for like mental health support around this. And so that's when I was diagnosed and I started formal treatment. And I think as for most people, especially those with marginalized bodies, eating disorder recovery was challenging. And there were a lot of times where it felt like, or I felt like the other again, you know, kind of back to like in an earlier part of my life where my experiences weren't shared with those around me or the providers I had.
Yeah. What was that like?
It was really difficult. I remember one example in particular of me having this place of discussing body image with one of my providers. And at that time, it was really hard for me to kind of speak up and bring something to my provider's attention that they may have been unaware of. And I remember I said to my provider, you know, I just don't think you understand some of the issues around body image, like as it relates to what goes on in Indian culture. And I remember like my provider, this thin white woman, like kind of putting her like chin up and shoulders back and said, you know, that hasn't been my observation of your culture.
What?
Yeah.
Oh.
And I felt so shut down because it's like when I tell you, Christy, I know I didn't say a big thing, but it was so hard for me. It was so hard for me to say that small thing.
Oh, yeah.
So there were just parts of me that I felt I had to leave at the door when it came to that stage of my recovery. And it really hindered my progress, like until I found a team that was affirming to like all of me. And I think that when things did start to turn around, one of the really important pieces was like reframing the way I put value in this idea of beauty.
Tell me more about that. What brought you to start reframing your idea of beauty?
I don't know how this came to me. I don't know if I heard it on a podcast. I'm not remembering it. If you know you mentioned it, let me know. But I just felt like when I walk into a room, like, what do I want to add to that room? Like, I'm not an ornament. I'm not a decoration. This idea of visual beauty is not something I want to place value in. And if I'm defining my worth by how far I can put myself in this idea of beauty, that I'm really limiting so much of myself. I have so much more to contribute than that at any way, shape, or size.
That reminds me of Beauty Redefined and their whole philosophy of like your body is an instrument, not an ornament. I think that's a quote from them. Just that you're not here to use your body as decoration. Like, yeah, you can, you know, dress it up and express yourself and whatever, and that's all cool, but it's not about that. Like, that's not your be all end all in life. You're here to do other things and to participate in life in other so many other ways, and every way that you want to show up, and like the way you look has so little to do with that.
Exactly. And if you just kind of think of every single person out there, everybody has so much to give this world. I mean, truly, everybody does. I'm a big believer in just everybody having a lot of potential, and we're all trying our best. But I wouldn't want anybody to feel like they're limiting themselves to just wanting to be putting their value in how beautiful they are. They are how they see it.
Totally. I mean, I talk a lot about diet culture as the life thief, you know, that it steals your time, your money, your well-being, your happiness, your mental energy, just like your ability to be present on this planet and engage in the things you want to engage in. And I see that so much in your story and what you're saying about like how you just put all your emphasis on beauty and how you appeared to the world. It's like all these other aspects of your life were getting stolen.
Yeah, I really couldn't agree more. When I think back to that time, I wasn't there with myself. And I wish I could go back and kind of give myself a hug and say, like, you're allowed to be who you are. You don't have to worry about these little things anymore.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like also for you, there was that piece of finding partnership and marriage and that sort of looming question over your head that probably made it feel like so important. And I can totally understand that. I understand why people feel so pushed into like making beauty a really central thing, because we're told that it's the key to all these other things we want in life. But it's awesome and amazing that you were able to get past that and get to a place where like you do ultimately have love and partnership in your life, but it's not with the prerequisites that you were told it would be.
Exactly. And when I just kind of examined my relationship, I've been with my husband from back then when I was this more shallow version of myself to now. And it just brought us so much closer. And I don't think that our marriage would be what it was if I still had this obsession with image and beauty.
And it's so awesome too, that like he was able to support you through that and still accepts you. That must have felt like such a relief, being known at a deeper level, that like you could show up with him as you really are and as this changing version of yourself, and that he still loves you through it.
Yeah, exactly. I do feel like we grew together around this, and the challenges around learning all of this and recovery, and we really grew together around it, thankfully.
Yeah, and that doesn't always happen, right? Like there's definitely probably some folks out there listening who've had partners get upset with them or drift away or have challenges in their relationships that were not surmountable when their bodies changed or when they decided to pursue recovery and their partners were still stuck in disorder, you know, aka the keto diet or whatever they were doing, you know, aka yeah, like the flavor of the month diet, but you know, a disordered relationship with food in their body.
Exactly. Yeah. I think, yeah, you have to be able to step away from a relationship like that. Like if it's not supportive of your recovery, it's just not supportive of you.
Yeah. And it's so hard to do that. It's so hard to set that boundary.
It is.
And there's that sort of discernment piece too, that you need to have, right? Of like, is this relationship something that we can grow together? And this is a hurdle and a sticking point that like eventually my partner will come around? Or is this something that they're just like really dug in about and not able to come around? And I'm curious actually to talk about sort of your own trajectory with that. Having like a lot of internalized fat phobia, being pretty fat phobic from what you've said before the weight gain, and then how your perception of larger bodies changed with your own experience.
I honestly think it goes back to when I started questioning the societal standard of beauty. And this was when I was still experiencing a lot of thin privilege. And my college roommate at the time, she's Black, and she was on this natural hair journey to stop using relaxers in her hair. And she explained this to me. And I was someone, like I mentioned, I have curly hair. And it's not at all the same thing of what she went through. But after she explained this to me and how the way we understand hair is so deeply entrenched in white supremacy, it just made me question that. And I stopped straightening my hair since. I haven't turned back. And like I said, it's nothing at all compared to what she or other Black people experience around hair, but it planted this seed to stay curious about the way I understand beauty. And so next I started to understand colorism. And as I tried to sit with my fat body, like in recovery, it was really hard because, like I said, I was really fat phobic and I just felt like I was at a war with my body. And so coming to this place of neutrality or acceptance, it felt really difficult, Christy. It was so difficult. And a big piece of it was finding support outside of sessions, like finding community and finding people that have lived experiences who've been through similar things that I've been through, who are also fat. Like that was such a big piece of it for me.
Yeah. And it sounds like your eating disorder treatment community, at least at first, was really not that space. Like there wasn't a lot of affirming of fatness and fat bodies.
Exactly. Yeah. And so from there, it felt kind of gradual. But I would say that when I started redefining the way I valued beauty, that's when it took a big turn.
That's huge. And I think that that probably speaks to a lot of folks listening who are in that boat, who are like trying to recover, but also have beauty as a value that's been really guiding them for a lot of their life, sort of starting to question that value and just question what you've been told about beauty is so important.
It really is. And it, like, I'm sure, I know you agree, but, and I know that fat bodies are beautiful. Like there's no question there. I'm just less concerned with trying to make sure I fit inside of whatever people are defining as beautiful.
Yeah. Like having your own definition of beauty or having beauty not even be that big of a defining factor for you.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, yeah, I'm curious like where your journey to become an RD kind of ties in with all of this stuff.
So if it's in there somewhere. So after I learned about intuitive eating, like I mentioned, I was just really surprised that I haven't heard about it sooner. So that's when I decided I really would love to support people on this. And I appreciated the science component of becoming a dietitian. Yeah, it just felt like it would be the right path for me. So I decided in my fat body that it's okay to be a dietitian. And I started, I have my master's in nutrition. I always tell people like it was definitely a rocky journey, but I did feel very supported towards the end of my master's program.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective too, to be someone who's coming from eating disorder recovery and decides to go into a dietetics program, which in a lot of ways is like the belly of the beast, you know? It's really so fat phobic in so many ways, the way that dietetics is trained and practiced at a lot of major institutions. But it sounds like you benefited from dietitians in treatment who were showing you a different model of what a dietitian could be.
Yeah, exactly. I felt supported beforehand. And then as I started studying, it just started to come together more. And I felt like I could be more vocal with certain professors. And then they were supportive. And fast forward to today, like the program director at that school, she includes weight stigma in to make sure that all the dietetic students get exposure to a weight stigma lecture. And then the dietetic internship at the University of North Carolina Greensboro, where I got my master's, now that there's a whole health and every size rotation, a whole rotation.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it blows my mind. Like myself, Julie Duffy Dillon, and a couple of other dietitians in that area, we've been working to create this option for people, because now there are more people who want to study nutrition but don't want to practice from this very traditional fat phobic diet weight centric approach.
Yeah, that's a lot of people who write into me, you know, who are listeners to the podcast, honestly. It's like dietitians to be who are like, I really want to do this. I want to become a dietitian so I can do what you do, be like an anti-diet dietitian. But how do I get there without having the training and like knowing that I have to go into this triggering environment? Did you ever find yourself triggered again when you were studying to become a dietitian? Because I know I did. Like I definitely had a few moments that worsened my disordered eating and threatened to pull me back into the eating disorder. And fortunately, I was able to kind of come through them stronger, but it's always a touch and go there, I think.
Yeah, gosh, there were so much more than a few moments. It was really exhausting. There was one piece where you hear messages around food that you know you don't really believe anymore, but then it's a different piece when you're sitting in a classroom, you're the only person in a large body, and you're just hearing professors tell you how to rid the world of bodies like yours. It's just, it's a lot to take in. It really is. And I want there to be more fat dietitians. And also I want dietetics to be safer in terms of training fat dietitians.
Yeah. And I think that's part of the reason why there aren't more fat dietitians, right? It's, you know, there's many reasons, like certainly economics plays a role in there too, because it's very expensive and a huge undertaking to become a dietitian. But yeah, that really significant fat phobia piece, I think really drives a lot of people away who would be great dietitians, but are fat. And, you know, would have that lived experience too of like knowing what weight stigma is and being able to live a different model of how to be a dietitian, like of doing an anti-diet type of work, who get sadly driven away by the fat phobia in the profession.
Yes, exactly. And I always ask myself, I wonder how Health at Every Size and Intuitive Eating, like how it would be different in dietetics if there were more fat dietitians.
It is interesting because I think one of the things about intuitive eating that gives some people pause, especially when they're first, I think it attracts some people who are maybe in a more diety place who are like, oh, all of these like thin providers who are doing intuitive eating, great, I'll be like them. Like they'll teach me how to be thin like them. And it's like, no, that's not, you can't teach that. You just, your body is what it is. I think people who are a little more aware of Health at Every Size or fat positivity first and like coming to it from that perspective tend to like look askance at a lot of those of us in thin bodies like myself who are doing intuitive eating work. And I think would probably, you know, those folks would feel a lot more comfortable with someone in a larger body that just gets what they've been through.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that as dietitians, if we're saying that only thin people should be dietitians, then you're really saying that part of the dietitian's role is to make people in larger bodies feel inferior for having different bodies.
Oh God, so true.
Yeah, it further pushes a stereotype, like this idea that body diversity shouldn't exist. And for me as a fat dietitian, part of showing up for my clients is showing up in my fat body as a woman of color doing this work.
Yeah, because you're providing such a different model for what a dietitian can be.
Exactly. And so when people are scared of being fat or super fat, like it's really a direct reflection like of their own body image struggles. And there's no hiding from it when you're like, yeah, there's really no hiding from it.
Right. And especially, yeah, when you're sitting in a room with someone and they're basically saying like, I don't want my body to look like yours. That's a real opportunity to kind of dig into what that means. Like, what does it mean for them to have to be in a super fat body or a fat body or whatever it is they're fearing?
Exactly. Exactly. I think that there are a lot of people that navigate through this world without being very close to someone who's fat or super fat. And so if I have a client who's been avoiding these bodies, and then I'm the one that's their dietitian, that's really nourishing the relationship with food and body, it really adds a whole layer of something that they haven't seen before.
Yeah, you can actually be like a almost an ambassador into the world of like, hey, look, people in fat bodies can do things in the world and can be really awesome.
Exactly. And for someone that's fat, it's like, hey, look, I'm not afraid of your body. If it's someone that's thin, hey, look, I'm not afraid of your changing body if that's happening.
Right. What's been your experience of life as a fat dietitian? Like now that you're out in the world doing this work and through the god-awful like obstacle course that is the process of becoming a dietitian, how do you feel like you're showing up and navigating all of these sort of different pressures?
I love it. It feels very liberating. I really enjoy telling people I'm a dietitian and watching them look a little confused and saying, I know why you're confused, but I'm here and I'm fat. And so I really enjoy it for a lot of reasons. I think that one of my favorite parts is modeling, just being in a larger body is okay. I've had clients tell me like, you're the first healthcare provider that I've had whose body looks like mine. And it's a really emotional process for them.
Yeah, that is powerful.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that come up. And it can be really complicated for some people who might be scared of fat bodies. And so if somebody is nervous about having a fat dietitian, but they want to learn more about this work, you know, okay, so you don't think I'm the best person for you, whoever you see, I hope that they recognize this fat phobia that you're struggling with, because I'm sure it's affecting your own growth in this area.
Yeah. And like you being a fat dietitian and encountering people with the fat phobia they bring into the room, like, has got to help, you know, that it's almost like a superpower in a way of like drawing out the fat phobia and helping people deal with it.
Yeah. And there's so much there. And I think it's really hitting it head on.
Right. And I think it's easier to, I know for me, when I first was starting out doing this work, where, you know, like we've talked about a lot on the podcast, where there's a fence straddling moment where you're like doing health at every size with some people, but like still trying to have one foot in the weight loss camp or in the like, I won't let you get fat and eating disorder recovery camp. I remember feeling very trepidatious about starting to like bring health at every size into that work, especially that the work that I was doing with like restrictive eating disorder clients, like people who were so fat phobic that they starved themselves basically because they abhorred the idea of fatness that much that, you know, they were sort of that far along on the fat phobia spectrum. Like, I think especially with those clients, I really had a lot of fear around speaking up about health at every size and bringing that into the conversation. So even though I was using health at every size principles in working with them, the actual addressing the fat phobia head on didn't happen until later, until I was like more rooted in this work. And I share a story in my book actually about this, like the first client that I ever opened up about health at every size to, who was an eating, like a restrictive eating disorder client, and my kind of hesitancy to do that in the first place. But then I just kind of like blurted it out in a session one day, and it was like this light bulb went off for her and actually really furthered her recovery. So it's kind of amazing what addressing fat phobia head on will do, even though we're all, I think, even providers are sort of inculcated by diet culture to be afraid of bringing it up.
Exactly. And if you're afraid to bring it up, you don't bring it up, you're really setting your client up for relapse in some ways. I mean, hopefully that's not the case, but by discussing body diversity and health at every size with them, you're preparing them for a lifetime with a body that's likely to change because we're human.
Yeah. And so, yeah, you're sort of inoculating them against hopefully future relapses, or at least giving them some of the tools to deal with them or deal with the struggles that are going to come up.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that kind of your example of how nervous you were around bringing it up and you went there and it was this great moment. Oh my gosh, that's the case with so many of my clients with the difficult topics, or even in my own personal therapy, like those difficult topics can be the ones that when you really go there, you lean in, the most rewarding outcomes are at the other side.
Yeah. It's just like getting over that hurdle of the societally entrenched beliefs about how we're not supposed to talk about these things.
Exactly.
And I love, so like I've seen you do a talk about weight stigma. You just did at the WIND conference, a weight inclusive nutrition and dietetics conference, and have given a similar talk at other venues. And it's usually audiences of healthcare providers in that setting. And like, I feel like that is such an important talk to be had, and for you to stand up there and model talking about weight stigma in a fat body, I think is a great example of like how to have those difficult conversations. And also it's forcing people to have that difficult conversation with you in their own mind anyway, as they're hearing you speak and watching you and sort of like internalizing these ideas about weight stigma or grappling with them themselves.
Yeah, I agree. I do. And I think a lot of times healthcare providers are only accustomed to being exposed to fat bodies as their clients or their patients. And so having that different relationship can really shift things.
Yeah, I think forcing people to have some collegial professional respect for somebody in a fat body probably like blows some people's minds at first.
Yeah.
Just like we know from the research that there's so much internalized fat phobia among healthcare providers. We see it in doctors. We see it in like these horrible statements that doctors and medical students make about people in larger bodies. We see this with dietitians and the rampant rates of eating disorders and orthorexia that happen in dietitians and the fat phobic statements that dietitians make. And, you know, just all across the board, every profession has these fat phobic beliefs really instilled in them.
Yeah, it's terrible.
It's really terrible. And I think, I mean, I'm starting to feel like talking to the healthcare providers and, you know, training the healthcare providers is going to be one really key front in this movement in this like war to end diet culture and fat phobia, because healthcare providers are such a source of shame and of keeping people stuck, you know, like you were talking about with the eating disorder treatment team that you saw, or the doctor who yelled at you. It's like, of course people are suffering, and of course people are diseases or conditions that people develop when they're in a larger body get blamed on the size, instead of people like considering at least, oh, maybe if I didn't yell at my client and cause them stress, they would have a better healthcare experience, or they would have a better health experience overall, because they're not being constantly stigmatized by me and everyone else in society.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like common sense when we're discussing it. And so it just really boggles my mind that some people still think it's acceptable.
It's wild. I mean, even doctors, you know, like my New York Times op-eds over the summer, like some people who are responding to them just willfully ignored everything that I said about the science on weight stigma. And we're like, what about this X pound patient who comes into my office and, you know, needs to lose weight? Am I supposed to just tell them to give up? And it's like, I get it. I can empathize with like feeling frustrated. And also, you're not really listening. You're not really listening to what I and all these different people in the health at every size field are saying about the problem with weight stigma.
That's what it sounds like. And I think sometimes their fat phobia is so loud that it kind of turns down the volume of the facts, like the research on this topic.
So true. Yeah. It just kind of drowns out everything else that people can be saying.
Exactly. Because it's not like the research is up to debate. Mm-hmm. Funny enough, even though you were asked to debate on it.
I know. Oh my God.
Yeah. It's not like the research is really up to debate. Like, we know that shaming people is not helpful for their health.
Right. That part. And I think it's always interesting to see diet culture denizens like twist themselves into pretzels to try to explain how they're anti-weight stigma, but they're still quote unquote helping people with weight management. It's like, okay, so you get that weight stigma is bad. You say you're on the same side with regard to that. And yet you're doing this thing that is actively stigmatizing people for their size. So tell me again how you're not doing weight stigma. Like, it just doesn't add up.
It doesn't. A fun exercise that I tell people to do when I speak is, whether you're a healthcare provider or a regular person, the fat people that you don't know, like if you're walking down the street and you see a fat person and you notice a reaction in your body, like that's your fat phobia. And that's something to really explore and work through, because it's going to come out in more ways than you think.
Oh, so true. That little whatever tightening happens in your body or quickening of your pulse or whatever is an example of a reaction that will, you know, lead to some different treatment of people in your office for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. And fat people can tell. I mean, like, we can tell when you're treating us differently.
I think that's a really important point too. Like, that really deserves to be said, because you pick up on it, right? That stigma is palpable.
Yeah. And I think sometimes providers think they're above it, like they know how to hide it, or they know how to be polite and kind of get through it. But yeah, you can tell from somebody's body language, they're avoiding eye contact. There are so many small indicators.
Right. And yeah, I think people, I've seen also just sort of flat out denial in some providers where they're like, well, I don't have weight stigma. I know it's bad and I don't do that to my clients. And like, oh, those are probably some of the worst offenders, right? The people who deny that they have even any of it.
Yeah, I agree. Like, we all have room to grow in this area, including myself. So if you haven't done this work, like, you're not exempt from the process.
And yeah, that's such a good point too, that it's an ongoing process, and that even fat people can have fat phobia after having done all the work. You still, or, you know, not all the work, but like all the work that you have done, you still have more to do and more unlearning. And so do I. And so does everybody else.
Exactly. I think that doing this means that you're constantly growing and learning and evolving.
Yeah. And I think that's part of the territory. You kind of have to just embrace that, like, constant learning and unlearning.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I could talk to you forever about these topics, and I know we will in New York City, because we're both in this area. So definitely have a lot more conversations offline coming up. But thank you so much for sharing all that you did and sharing your story and your presence with us. And can you tell us where people can find you and learn more about your work?
Yeah, thanks for having me. So you can find me at bodypositivedietitian.com or on Instagram at bodypositive_dietitian.
Awesome. We'll link to that in the show notes too, so people can find you. And so excited for everybody to check out your work.
Great. Thanks.
And that's our show. Thanks again so much to Kimmy Singh for joining us on this episode. And thanks to you for listening. If you're looking for some tips and guidance to help you get started on the anti-diet path, grab my free audio guide, 7 Simple Strategies for Finding Peace and Freedom with Food. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/strategies to get it. That's ChristyHarrison.com/strategies. If you've gotten something out of this podcast, please help us reach more people who need to hear the anti-diet message by sharing and subscribing on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platforms, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, we're at all of them. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe to see all the places you can subscribe. That's ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. You can also leave us a nice rating and review in your podcast provider of choice, which is another way to help new listeners discover us and is always really helpful to me to help me keep going and keep doing this work. To get full show notes from this episode, including all the resources we discussed, plus a full transcript, head over to ChristyHarrison.com/214. That's ChristyHarrison.com/214. And to get the transcript, just scroll down to the bottom of the page and enter your email address. This episode was brought to you by my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. If you're ready to make peace with food, break free from diet culture, and reclaim the life it stole from you, learn more and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course. That's ChristyHarrison.com/course. A big thanks, as always, to our editor and sound engineer, Mike Lalonde, our community and content associate, Vinci Chui, and our administrative assistant, Julianne Watasek, for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show every week. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography and designed by Meredith Noble, and our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay psyched.
Reggie, I just sold my car online.
Let's go, Grandpa. Wait, you did?
Yep, on Carvana. Just put in the license plate, answered a few questions, got an offer in minutes. Easier than setting up that new digital picture frame.
You don't say.
Yeah, they're even picking it up tomorrow. Talk about fast.
Wow, way to go. So, about that picture frame.
Forget about it. Until Carvana makes one, I'm not interested.
Car selling made easy. On Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.